World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. This program is presented in behalf of Admiral dealers all over America by shortwave broadcast direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country. CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Robert Trout.
General Doi Hara is now in prison, the latest of the Japanese military leaders to be taken into custody by the United States 8th Army. This is the man who was chief of the Japanese Army Intelligence Service at Mukden while Japan was seizing Manchuria. He's been described as the brains of the Kwangtung Army. Later, he played an important part in the war against China, in the intrigues leading to that war, and in the military aggression that followed. Only last week, General Doi Hara was given a new high position. The Japanese government appointed him to take the place of Field Marshal Sugiyama, a recent suicide, as commander of the 1st Army District, and the Allied occupation commanders approved his appointment. When General Doi Hara visited General Eichelberger at 8th Army headquarters in Yokohama, the American general announced that the Japanese general appeared to be courteous and cooperative. There have been no further reports on his courtesy, but General Doi Hara's cooperation lasted only a brief time. 2 days ago, the Supreme Allied Commander ordered the Japanese general arrested. Yesterday, despite the order for his arrest, General Doi Hara continued working at his desk in the War Ministry. Today, he was delivered by the Japanese to American officials at Yokohama and is now in prison there. No specific war crimes have been charged against this man. However, even though he is not yet accused of being in the strict sense a war criminal, his arrest gives us an example of the way in which the occupation is being carried out under the instructions sent to General MacArthur before the signing of the surrender and made public yesterday evening by the White House. It gives us an example of how we can use that directive as a guide in following the progress of the occupation and in judging the accuracy of some of the criticism and arguments which have surrounded the operation this past week. Looking at the White House statement, we find that in addition to the instructions on the arrest and punishment of war criminals, there are at least two sections of the directive which apply to the arrest of a man like General Doi Hara. Under Part 1, entitled Ultimate Objectives, the instructions read, Japan will be completely disarmed and demilitarized. The authority of the militarists and the influence of militarism will be totally eliminated from her political, economic, and social life. Now, that's a broad, sweeping statement, but farther along in the document, the same idea is repeated in more definite and detailed terms. In Part 3, entitled Political, the first section is called Disarmament and Demilitarization, and here are a few sentences taken from that section. Disarmament and demobilization are the primary tasks of the military occupation and shall be carried out promptly and with determination. High officers of the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters and General Staff, other high military and naval officials of the Japanese government, leaders of ultra-nationalist and militarist organizations, and other important exponents of militarism and aggression will be taken into custody and held for future disposition. It's true the language is a bit dry and dusty. Official documents are not often exciting to read. As in legal papers, the words are selected not on the basis of pleasant sounds and attractive rhythms, but chosen with a view to making misunderstanding impossible. There's been a good deal of misunderstanding in recent days by those who did not know that this document existed and who thought that General MacArthur might be tempted to make his own foreign policy because he had not been given adequate instructions by the government. But now the initial policy governing Japan has been revealed. Everyone can see for himself how the actual developments in Japan compare with the instructions. The case of General Doi Hara is merely the latest example. Yesterday, General MacArthur asked for details of the Emperor's fortune. That is authorized by the very last paragraph of the directive, which says, Imperial household property shall not be exempted from any action necessary to carry out the objectives of the occupation. There'll be more examples as time goes on. At this moment, Washington struggles with further policymaking in many fields, so that those entrusted with the carrying out of the government's business may know in advance what our course is. And to hear more of some of these current problems, we take you to Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
This week will be one of decision in Washington. The spread of strikes and threatened walkouts in basic industries has forced the issue on wages, prices, and legislative program. The White House has been advised that reconversion may be stalled unless the strike issues are settled. And organized labor apparently wants to know what the administration is going to do about take-home wages, prices, and full employment before it sits down at the conference table. The full employment bill comes out on the floor of the Senate for debate on Tuesday. There will be some indicative votes during the week. Already, some of the conservatives have begun the attack on full employment. Senator McClellan of Arkansas called the bill a fraud in a caustic speech in Congress last week. The wage policy is up in the air. President Truman appeared to repudiate the theory of increasing wages up to new high levels while holding prices at his news conference on Wednesday. OPA Chief Chester Bowles raised the issue of price controls in a frank speech Thursday night. He, in effect, asked the administration whether it was going to hold the line all the way or give in here and there where pressure was applied. President Truman this weekend tried to line up the Democrats in Congress behind his program. He spent 2 days with them at nearby Jefferson Island. Thus far, Mr. Truman has had no more luck than Franklin Roosevelt in healing the breach between the liberal and conservative wings of his party. In fact, some of the votes on the jobless insurance bill amendments last week revealed he had lost ground. The most profound item on the foreign affairs budget, the $3 to $6 billion loan to Great Britain, is still being debated. The British have completed their case for a loan. The man on whom President Truman will rely most for guidance has not been convinced. He is Leo Crowley, head of the Foreign Economic Administration. According to his associates, Crowley is irritated because the British have refused to get down on their knees and say, "We are broke. Please help us." Instead, their attitude has been, "This loan will be good medicine for both of us." I return you to Admiral in New York.
Thus, the story from Washington. Now for a report from our correspondent in the Philippines, Admiral takes you to CBS Manila, John Adams reporting.
It can never be said that freedom of the press is lacking in the Philippines in 1945. The 20-odd tabloid newspapers that have sprung up here since Manila was liberated in February are having a Roman holiday in sensational yellow journalism, political mudslinging, and fiction reporting, in what appears to be an effort to make up for 3.5 years of Japanese press and propaganda control. During the past week, various papers have demanded everything from the impeachment of President Osmeña and the arrest of Senate President Manuel Rojas to charging Secretary Ickes with blackmail. Collaborationists have been both accused and condoned, and it's a rare day when some public official is not slandered and fried in print. Many of the papers are controlled by various political or economic groups, and their partisan interests frequently burst with atomic repercussions. One paper demanded President Osmeña's resignation after a rabid anti-Osmeña political leader from Cebu attacked the record of Osmeña's sons during the war. Others attacked Senate President Rojas on the strength of a critical New York newspaper editorial. And today, one tabloid carried a banner line, "Demand Rojas arrest and trial," based on nothing more than a radical petition which was circulated about the city. This same paper carried a feature article titled, "Mr. Ickes' Blackmail Attempt," and scored the Interior Secretary for his recent warning to the Philippines that those guilty of collaboration should be convicted and punished. Otherwise, relief and rehabilitation aid might be reluctantly appropriated. Declaring Mr. Ickes' message might well have come from a Nazi Gauleiter, the article said, "We cannot see why Mr. Ickes had to behave like a bully and employ the tactics of a blackmailer." Ironically, an editorial on another page listed several alleged fallacies of the American press: the fallacy of insufficient evidence, of distorted facts, and of inaccurate basic information. More conservative papers, however, have been quick to condemn journalistic excesses on the plea that they may cause serious and lasting repercussions abroad. Philippine radio is not suffering from such excesses. There are only two stations in Manila, one run by the Army, the other by the OWI. This is John Adams in Manila. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Next, a word from Warren Sweeney. Soon your Admiral dealer will be able to show you Admiral radios and radio phonographs with automatic record changers.
All of them will be brand new 1946 sets, not pre-war models just made over. There'll be many completely new features developed by War Production to make your new Admiral all you've been hoping for. Your dealer will have Admiral accessories, too. Admiral Lifetime Precious Jewel Phonograph Needles, Admiral Replacement Tubes, dry batteries for portables and farm sets, and Admiral Record Cabinets. Admiral Major Appliances, too, with many new and exclusive features, will set the pace for more gracious living. For example, Dual Temp, really two refrigerators in one, will have these exciting features. A built-in home freezer, a purified moist cool compartment with no defrosting and no covered dishes, more room for food because there are no space-stealing coils, and Sterilamp protection for foods. Admiral electric ranges and home freezers have equally new features and refinements. You can learn more of the beauty and fine mechanical qualities of all Admiral products if you'll write for a free copy of a 16-page, full-colored booklet called It's a Promise from Admiral. Simply write your name and address on a penny postcard and mail it to Admiral in care of the radio station to which you are now listening. That's all. Just your name and address, mail to Admiral. Now, here once again is Robert Trout.
The problems of Europe are more and more the problems of America. In London, five high officials of state seek solutions for the difficult situations which grew out of World War II. For a report on their progress, Admiral takes you to London, Charles Shaw reporting.
A favorite intellectual pastime these days in London, and I suppose in other capitals, is branding the culprit nation responsible for the big five foreign ministers' lack of accomplishments at their meetings here. Russia, at the moment, seems to be the popular choice here. But impartial observers aren't willing to absolve the United States and Britain of all blame. The truth seems to be that none of the big three foreign ministers has been willing to give as much as he wants to take. Nationalism and power politics are at the moment ascendant over international cooperation for the preservation of peace. There has been surprise that Russia wants a foothold in the Mediterranean area. That's surprise despite the fact that the Mediterranean area is as close geographically to Russia as to Britain. Russia has been criticized for forming an Eastern European bloc, even though the United States has established its influence over the whole Western Hemisphere and a good part of the Pacific. And if reports received here are complete and accurate, the United States shows no disposition to let any other country in on the occupation and treatment of Japan. Not even as much as the Russians have let us in on the occupation and treatment of vast parts of Germany and her old satellites. On the other hand, Russia goes about concluding a sweeping trade treaty with a Hungarian government the Americans and British have denounced, and apparently without telling the other allies about it in advance. Russia's general hard-headed unilateral actions certainly haven't pleased the other allies. The British government, at the same time, is criticized by British liberals for her support of the Greek government, which the Russians claim is as undemocratic as we claim the Hungarian, Bulgarian, and Romanian governments are. The French and Chinese foreign ministers, meanwhile, have been mainly spectators at the meetings, a couple of country cousins. Prime Minister Attlee conferred on the foreign minister's stalemate this afternoon with his foreign secretary, Mr. Bevan. And the weekly news magazine, The New Statesman, says in its current issue, before the disconcerted eyes of peoples terribly conscious that real Big Five collaboration is the only alternative to catastrophe, the Council of Foreign Ministers, true to the fatal traditions of power politics, is playing a tragic comical game of strip poker. If we forget that civilization in Europe and the Pacific alike is in peril and continue to maneuver with an eye to blocks and balances of power, we shall reach an impasse in which the atom bomb spells common extinction. This is Charles Shaw in London. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
In another part of Europe, in Rome, other people struggle to regain a satisfactory peacetime existence. Admiral now takes you to Rome, Winston Burdett reporting.
The story of Italy's illegal arms traffic is one which may hold the key to political events in this country in coming months. Allied police authorities are frankly worried, and they express strong doubts as to whether the Italian police could cope with any armed uprising when Allied troops pull out. Allied police officials will tell you that Italy's leading political parties are today racing to get arms. They say that not some, but all of the major parties are building up their own armed stores. They believe that the two best-armed parties today are the Communists and the Christian Democrats, in that order. Our police authorities admit very frankly that the Allied campaign to persuade Italian partisans in the north to surrender the arms we dropped to them was a failure. The partisans made a token surrender of arms, including old blunderbusses and hunting rifles, but they kept many well-cased and well-greased machine guns, and they're known to have some anti-tank guns and the ammunition for them. There have been several sources of arms in Italy. Many were picked up from battlefields before Allied salvage squads could get them. Some were bought from Allied troops. Across the northeast frontier in Venezia Giulia, Italians have bartered wheat for weapons, and a certain amount of arms has been smuggled to southern Italy across the Adriatic from Yugoslavia. The Italian parties can now build up their stores on the market. The prices have been quoted in the Rome papers, $15 for a hand grenade, $120 for a rifle. Recently, Allied military police have carried out several determined arms searches and seizures in the north, but nobody can estimate how many arms are still out. There have been recurrent reports that an insurrectional movement would break out soon after Allied military government withdrew from northern Italy. The Allies have repeatedly postponed their departure, and rumor each time has postponed the date for the supposed uprising. But these reports have been substantial and serious enough to keep Allied authorities worried. At the same time, the Communist press has charged that Italian industrialists in the north are building up their defense fund and arms store. The Allied police are aware of this move, too. In this situation, the six-party Italian government can do very little. The parties which form the government are themselves contending for control of Italy's police, and in the meantime are arming against each other. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
France is preparing for local elections. Admiral takes you now to Paris. Douglas Edwards reporting.
The people of Paris and their guests, the soldiers of America, have spent a fairly typical Sunday. They went to church, there have been walks in the park, along the boulevards and the Seine, and at Longchamp the horses ran the customary seven races. But despite this leisurely picture, there has been some business in Paris today and throughout France. It was local election day when, for the first time in years, the people of the various French departments went to the polls to choose representatives in their local governments. They correspond to our own state legislatures. This morning's Paris press seemed pretty unanimous, as it has for days, in the opinion that the voters today were in reality giving a preview of how the nation will go in October at the general elections. The papers would have their readers believe that the history of France for the next 50 years was being written at the polls. Whether that's true or not, time will be the teller. And the only prediction qualified observers will make is that if there is any real trend, it will be to the left, which is not exactly surprising. And by the way, in that particular, on Tuesday of this week, a conference will open here in Paris, during which its proponents believe there will be created a World Federation of Trade Unions. This morning, in his suite at the famous Grand Hotel, Sidney Hillman, chairman of the CIO delegation, met correspondents and gave them a little background on the movement. Hillman, who incidentally has a son-in-law who is an employee of the American Embassy as labor attaché, having been appointed a good many months ago, Sidney Hillman told us that the spadework for this meeting had been done last winter in conferences in Paris and London, and it was hoped and believed, said he, that this Paris meeting will end with the establishment of an international labor organization. Hillman said the primary object was to make sure that the world stays at peace through a globe-spanning brotherhood of the little men, the men who don't want the wars in the first place. He said labor should have a voice in the peace because labor, with management, had a top part in winning the war. The AFL, he said, has refused to join the current conference, but Hillman feels sure it will eventually because, as he put it, the AFL is virtually isolated by the presence here of representatives of the two main railway brotherhoods. And he added that isolation goes for John L. Lewis, too. Hillman believes that if the nations of the world in 1936 and 1937 had realized that an agreement was available and possible on all basic problems, it is possible there never would have been a war in the first place. And he is confident that a world labor union is capable of averting another. This is Douglas Edwards in Paris, returning you to Admiral in New York.
Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott, has been in Washington these past few days, inquiring into the state of the Pearl Harbor investigation. For his report, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Major Elliott reporting.
The five senators and the five representatives who make up the Congressional Pearl Harbor Investigating Committee met during this past week for their first preliminary discussion. Talking to some of these gentlemen, the impression is very definite that they want to do a constructive job, that they are not looking for scapegoats and sensational headlines, but that they are, for the most part, anxious that their investigation and report shall be a useful contribution in formulating sound military and foreign policies for the future. Naturally, in the committee selected along political lines and composed of men in political life, political considerations cannot be kept wholly out of the picture. There will be a tendency for the Democratic members of the committee to seek to pass over lightly any criticism of the late President Roosevelt, for example. And there will be a tendency for the Republican members to try to emphasize such criticisms if they arise. But as one committee member pointed out, this will be the fourth official investigation of Pearl Harbor and probably the last. The public will expect something more than denunciations and criticism. It will expect constructive results that will have a part in guarding the country against any future disaster of the sort. The committee meets under conditions which will make such results a necessity. For it meets under the shadow of the atomic bomb and the other new and terrible weapons which this war has developed. Present in the minds of all the members must be the grim realization that if we are taken by surprise again, the results will not be merely a temporary setback, the loss of a certain number of ships and planes, and of 3,000 lives, but in all probability, complete national disaster, the loss of the war in the first few hours of sudden and devastating attack. It's along these lines that the members of the committee must be thinking and will be thinking as they examine the evidence that will be laid before them. Their reputations are at stake and they know it. The country will be impatient with any attempt to make too much political capital out of an investigation whose results are fraught with such momentous possibilities. The members will be thinking less of just what should be the measure of responsibility assigned to this or that individual, and more about why the whole system worked so badly, why there wasn't a better balance between military and foreign policy, and why democracies must always be taken by surprise, or must they from now on? Wise considerations of these questions may lay the foundation of our future security. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
In Tokyo, General MacArthur, acting at the request of the Philippine Senate, demanded today that the Japanese furnish his headquarters with a complete report on Filipino soldiers and civilians removed from the islands during the enemy occupation. The request was forwarded to General MacArthur in the form of a formal resolution passed by the Senate of the Philippines. And now, here once again is Warren Sweeney.
For three full years, every Sunday for 156 weeks, Admiral Corporation has brought you World News Today as a public service. Admiral felt the American public deserved to get war news from all fronts in a complete and authentic manner. Admiral has been proud to be identified with a program so timely and so well accepted as World News Today has been. With the world at peace and our fighting men and women beginning to come home, Admiral is discontinuing its sponsorship of this program, although at least temporarily, Columbia will continue the program on an unsponsored basis. In parting, Admiral wants to thank all staff members of the Columbia Broadcasting System for their fine cooperation and excellent handling of World News Today. Columbia's far-flung news-gathering sources and representatives in every corner of the globe have made it possible to give you the news while it is still new. Admiral extends a special thanks to you, the listeners to World News Today. Your regular interest and your many fine letters have been very gratifying. Admiral shall always remember you and trust that when you think of radios and major appliances, you will think of Admiral. Remember Admiral as the maker of Admiral Radio, America's smart set, dual-temp refrigerators, electric ranges, and home freezers. This is Warren Sweeney saying goodbye from Admiral. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is the WBVM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago, a transcribed announcement.